Welcome to episode 2 of the Yes Music Podcast, one fan's exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm Kevin Mulryan, your host, and it's been quite a week since I recorded episode 1. Twitter followers, subscriptions, comments, altogether it adds up to a building community, which is absolutely fantastic, especially as this is only episode 2. So I'm going to do something now which I'm not going to do every episode, but it's been such a significant week that I'm going to see if I can mention as many people as I can who've been part of that community building activity. So I'm really sorry if I miss anyone out. Please contact me if I've missed you out, and I'll make sure I mention you in the next episode. So comments on the website have been from people like Sergio, from some people's names I don't even know, from Ad Tradzuko, from Mike Murphy, and from Thomas Dobson, who points out that Astral Traveller, which we're going to talk about in a minute, might be the best precursor to what Yes was going to be, Tony Kaye and Peter Banks setting the template. Nick Daffis, Michael Williams, and Rick Dante needs a special mention of danteprog.com, and if you don't know that website, get over there, it's absolutely fantastic, particularly as Rick has been kind enough to put a banner ad on it for the Yes Music Podcast. Thanks very much for that, Rick, and I'm just waiting for Rick to get one over to me, and I'll do that reciprocally on the Yes Music Podcast side. Paul Wilson also made a comment, and he's been out and bought. Yes, after listening to last week's from iTunes, which was fantastic. And he points out that Danny Baker even played No Opportunity Necessary, No Experience Needed, which we'll be talking about in a minute, on BBC London between 3 and 5 p.m, which is fantastic news. Maybe not as a result of hearing the Yes Music Podcast, but you never know. Conversations have been brilliant also on Twitter, and I'm going to mention a lot of people on Twitter now, just very quickly. Mark Toner, again, he needs special mention because he was kind enough to mention the Yes Music Podcast on the Facebook Yes page, the official Facebook Yes page, because I'm not a member of Facebook at the moment. I won't go into why not at the moment, but if you want to ask me about that, I'm happy to give you my feelings on Facebook. And his day job is the creation of fantastic comics. Go along to www.spacepilot.co.uk and have a look at what he does. It's great stuff. So some other tweeters, at Brenband, at Kate Little, at Mozardian, at Stevie Sharman, and at MJMurphy61, who commented as well and runs several fascinating sites like twilightguitar.wordpress.com. Get over there. At Iron1467, I have to mention, because that's my son. At __PQ, at Amara of the fantastic www.silhobbit.com, at Justin Hoops, at The Weems, which is Michael Williams, he's commented as well twice on the blog, which is fantastic, at Tuskman Blue, at Space Station M, at Beatwood Mac, at Mike Conway, at Ranch 42, at Blue Macintosh, the list goes on, at Will W6, at Gitsy Bets, that's Gary. He also emailed me and mentioned something which I've actually taken action on this week, which is the featured musician section. And I agreed with him that it's not really, I haven't really got time in these podcasts to go into enough detail on each of the musicians, so I'm going to devote a future episode to each musician, and we're just going to concentrate on the albums in this weekly podcast. Other tweeters, at Image Escape Girl, at Michuru Karuma, I hope I've pronounced these correctly, at Jun Frither, at Sarok, at Progrock Passion, at Nail Music, at Juiced Maglev, at Jennings P, that's P-E-A, at Pilo J Rice, at Corey Had a Lil Lambs, and finally, at Prog_Rules. In fact, if you want to follow these people, just go along to Twitter, have a look at Yes Music Podcast's followers. You can see all these folks there and follow them yourself. So after that, just remember the ways to get involved with the Yes Music Podcast via the site. Leave some comments there, listen to the podcasts there, and make sure that you subscribe there, please. It's very important that you subscribe so I know how many people are listening and can contact you that way. Leave comments there, as I say. Email show at yesmusicpodcast.com. Twitter is at Yes Music Podcast, of course, and no one's been brave enough yet to leave a voicemail message, which I will definitely play on the show if you do, by calling 0844 579 6949 and using the mailbox number 39417. So, enough with all that. Let's get back to what the Yes Music Podcast is all about, the music of Yes. So this week it's the 1970 featured album, Time and a Word. Interestingly enough, this is my birth year, 1970, so you can instantly work out how old I am. It was the second album the band produced, and of course you will have heard of the second difficult album syndrome. What to do with your second album if your first has been a success? How do you follow it up with the same kind of quality? This is the same personnel as the first album, and that's for the last time. So the same group of musicians, but for the next album there is a pretty significant change that we'll come back to next week. As usual, Yes never seem to take the obvious path, so instead of a follow-up album with pretty much the same kind of music on it, they decided to add a lot of orchestral arrangements, which were done by Tony Cox. Now, I have to straight away point out my reservations about that. I have a kind of romantic view of what a band should be, a band is. The band members write, record, and do everything on the records. It's probably a fairly silly view, but that was my view. For example, Queen used to have a no synthesizers rule and never employed any musicians, any session musicians, any arrangers. It was just the four of them. Even when they played live, they made it clear that it was just the four of them playing live, unless they left the stage, which they used to do for Bohemian Rhapsody, as you probably know, the middle section, the operatic section. So what do I think of the Tony Cox orchestral arrangements on Time and a Word? Well, I know that a lot of other people think it's very contrived, think it's been added on afterwards as an afterthought, but actually I don't. Maybe because it's an album I've been listening to for years and years, maybe I've just got used to it, but it seems pretty well integrated to me. Obviously you'll be wanting to compare it to things like the single from Big Generator, Love Will Find a Way, that Trevor Rabin did the orchestration himself of a string quartet there. I think Time and a Word stands up very well in comparison with that. Magnification, a much more recent album by the band, also has excellent orchestration in it, I think, and we'll be coming onto that album, obviously. Another album that you may not know about is called Symphonic Music of Yes, 1993 album, with some orchestrations by David Palmer. The London Philharmonic, the English Chamber Orchestra, London Community Gospel Choir all got involved, but it also features Steve Howe, Bill Bruford, and John Anderson. Personally, I think that album is less successful than something like Time and a Word. Some of the orchestrations do seem a bit contrived. Might also be interesting to compare the orchestration on Time and a Word to something like Deep Purple's slightly obscure Concerto for Group and Orchestra, which was written by the keyboard player John Lord. But we haven't got time for that now. I'll put a YouTube video link into the show notes. So while listening to Time and a Word, I was struck by a few themes which seemed to be there. The theme of contrasts, and that's contrasts between the different tracks and also within the tracks themselves, and I'll be talking about that quite a bit as we go through. The use of classical music structures. Again, you could read too much into that, but there are times when it seems like there are some structures there which are common to this album and to classical music. A juxtaposition of textures, smooth and spiky textures going on at the same time, providing some more contrast. And we'll see all these as we go through. The album actually opens with one of the most controversial tracks, No Opportunity Necessary, No Experience Needed. It's one of two covers on the album by Richie Havens, the American folk singer and guitarist. And possibly because it's a cover, John starts off by singing very low, John Anderson. And if we just digress for a moment, there's been some recent controversy over changing the keys of Yes songs to make them lower for John, while he was still with the band, for John to sing them. Now, I've got particular views about that. I know other people have had to do it as well. Other bands have changed the keys to make them lower so that people can cope. And really, if you think about it, this is part of getting older. The band, including John Anderson, are getting older. It happens. And it's purely physiological. As you get older, your voice gets lower. You can't do anything about it. It just happens. So personally, I don't see a problem with it. Change the key, sing it, no problems for me. I wonder if it made it easier to justify leaving John out of the band. Maybe. There's one for you to contact me about if you want to. It brings us back to the dysfunctional nature of Yes. Are they the most dysfunctional band ever? Probably not. But back to Time and a Word. The real controversy is around the orchestral arrangement in No Opportunity Necessary, particularly the inclusion of the Wild West theme, and I think it's from The Magnificent Seven, let me know if that's not right. The orchestra and Peter Banks, with his wah-wah pedal, break into the Wild West theme right in the middle of the song. Oddly, this seems very natural to me, and I wonder if it's again because I know it so well. What do you think? It's another example of Yes including snippets of other music in their songs. We'll see that later again on this album as well. I can't listen to that part of No Opportunity Necessary without a smile on my face, and I'm just wondering, it's surely not meant to be serious, is it? Surely it's a bit of a joke. The whole track is a real toe-tapper, it's fun, it's joyful music. So make up your own mind about that inclusion of the Magnificent Seven theme tune, and let me know what you think. So the theme of the album, as I said before, light and shade, contrast, and for example, you get a lot of contrast between No Opportunity and the second track, Then. For me, it seems to capture the spirit of 1970. I was only a baby, obviously, as I wouldn't really know, but at least the most positive, optimistic aspects of the time seem to be encompassed by Then, and actually on some other tracks on the album as well. Then is an Anderson composition. Perhaps that accounts for the mood. The mood can be seen very clearly in the words of the chorus. Only us who can change it, only us to rearrange it, sings John. It's totally different in style and feel to No Opportunity, with the orchestration very tightly integrated again. Definitely not an afterthought, if you ask me. The other theme of juxtaposition of texture is also shown in different ways inside Then and other tracks. You've got John's clear, smooth vocals in the verses alongside some pretty frenetic drumming of Bill Bruford and some spiky interjections from the other band members and from the orchestration. We'll see this again in Astral Traveller. If you ignore the vocal effect in Astral Traveller, it's quite a smooth, melodic line with a complex texture underneath. The complexity of drumming and the organ is a contrasting bed with flowing vocal line above. There's also a contrast between this and the uplifting, joyous, almost sing-along chorus of this track. It's this variety and complexity of texture and mood which is part of what makes Yes music so fascinating, of course. But what about the other theme identified, classical influences on structure? You can see this particularly in a couple of tracks, Astral Traveller and Everydays. In Astral Traveller, as mentioned earlier, by Thomas Dobson, he calls it the best precursor to what Yes was going to be. It contains the first appearance of what is obviously the astral theme in Yes music, and the first of many. Another one that I can think of off the top of my head is in Tormato, Arriving UFO. The effect put on Anderson's vocals is the only one I can think of in all Yes music. Tell me if I'm wrong, but I can't think of another example where vocals in a Yes album are given such a treatment. It gives a very otherworldly effect, but I feel it feels appropriate to the song for me. Alongside some great offbeat patterns in the chorus from the rhythm section, there's the Tony Kaye and Peter Banks interlude. This might be slightly odd on first hearing, but this is where I think the classical influence creeps in. It's a bit like a development section in a sonata structure. If you have no idea what I'm talking about, then just Google it. Google sonata structure and you'll see. In sonata structure you have something called an exposition, a development and a recapitulation. Can you see those in this piece? I'm not sure. It probably doesn't bear close scrutiny, but I think the influence is clear. And there's definitely that contrast again between the sections. So Everydays is another example of this. It's a Stephen Stills composition, originally recorded by Buffalo Springfield. But it gets the Yes treatment, a bit like other cover versions that we've already mentioned last week, like America. Originally, the song is a fairly straight one, but Yes develop into a more of a mystical feel. There's a suspension of the beat and pulse. There they play with the form, contrasts again in speed. And the middle section, once again, there's a kind of development section, going back to that sonata structure, with the original jazz influence of the Buffalo Springfield song developed a lot further by Banks. He really takes a bit of a flight of harmonic fantasy in the middle there. And the jazz influence again can be seen when the whole band play the theme. Banks even manages to throw in a reference to J.S. Bach. If you listen carefully, you'll hear him play part of the introduction to Jesu, Joy of Man's Desiring. See if you can spot that. A real high point for me. There's even a recapitulation, with the opening section reappearing. There's the echoes of the middle section and then a climactic and startling ending. There really is an overwhelming amount to talk about with time and a word. It's complex and fascinating. So what are the other highlights then? Well, the track Clear Days, it's a beautiful piece featuring Anderson. He does sound a bit hoarse on this recording, it's always struck me as slightly strange. The string quartet though and Tony Kaye on piano make it such a wonderful piece. Obviously, you're going to be drawing comparisons between Clear Days and something like the Beatles' Yesterday and Love Will Find a Way that we mentioned earlier, both of which have string quartets as a backing. Interestingly, just as a slight digression, I've got an anecdote about the Beatles recording Yesterday. When I was young, I played in a youth orchestra, and the conductor was the brother of the viola player who played on Yesterday and other Beatles tracks. And when they got to the recording studio, they met George Martin, and George Martin said to them, "Don't worry about anything you've learnt in college, guys. All we want is a good scratch." There you go. Anecdote finished. Back to Clear Days. I love the arrangement of the strings, but I found myself wondering about it. What would it be like if you took the strings away and you just had Tony Kaye's piano there? It made me think of the more recent Yes acoustic experiments, which I think are very effective. Rick Wakeman on the piano and the other acoustic instruments there. How much do the strings add in Clear Days? Well, I think it's definitely authentic string writing. I think it sounds like a string quartet. And actually, in some ways, I think it's better than the George Martin Yesterday arrangement. The track has a bit of an abrupt ending, but apart from that, I think it's very well done. What do you think? Let me know. So on to Sweet Dreams, then. This only features the band. There's no orchestration, there's no orchestra, there's no other instruments there, no arrangement, just the band. I think this one's got a great sense of direction. Strikes me that it'd probably be good driving music. Stick it on, stick the top down, off you go. Not that I've got a convertible car. It's simple but very effective with a great groove, which I think is generated mainly by the rhythm section there. It's positive, upbeat, almost sing-along. There's a couple of tracks which you could sing along to on this album. Not something perhaps that you associate with Yes particularly. Again, it's a great contrast to the previous track of Every Day's. In The Prophet, I think Tony Kaye deserves a special mention for the opening. It's dark and mysterious, and suggestive of the mystical title of the piece. However, once again, there's a contrast to a more positive feeling later in the song. Texture contrasts again, as frenetic drums make another appearance beneath smoother lyrics. Jazz improvisation also definitely there as well, and very effective use of the brass arrangement particularly. Towards the end, the arrangement reminds me very much of the America mode of the band. Light and shade ending with virtuosic drumming and a positive rock finish. A great track. So finally, let's get round to the title track, Time and a Word. Now in this, Yes achieve early in their career what most other bands never do. So this is a timeless track, anthemic sing-along with that repeated refrain. Reminds you of Hey Jude and All You Need Is Love. And the test of a good song like this is that this could really last 20 minutes without getting boring. You can imagine the whole crowd singing along to this and getting a lot out of it. I think it's down to the orchestration, to the strength of the refrain, the lyrics of the opening of the song and the whole theme there of the morning, getting up, getting ready for the refrain. It all builds brilliantly towards that refrain. Once again, we see uplifting, positive lyrics and theme of this song. And there's a contrast between the comparatively low pitch in vocal line in the verses and the higher pitch in the chorus. And I think that helps the uplifting feel. It makes a fantastic end to the album. It makes you feel that, indeed, the time is now and the word is love. So that's about it for Time and a Word and the podcast this week. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed it. Next week we move on to the next studio album, which is slightly confusingly entitled The Yes Album. Sounds like the first one, but is in fact the third. And it sees the arrival, no pun intended, of guitar virtuoso Steve Howe. What difference does he make to the music? Well, your homework is to listen to The Yes Album and see what you think, and then see if you agree with me in the podcast next week. Remember, also get involved with the podcast, www.yesmusicpodcast.com. Leave some comments there if you would, please. Contact me at yesmusicpodcast on Twitter. Do keep sending emails to show@yesmusicpodcast.com, and I really am waiting for that first person to leave the voicemail on 0844 579 6949 using the mailbox number 39417. So until next time, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.